Hello, and welcome to Controlled Pod into Terrain. We're doing something a little different today, and we'll get to that in a second. My name is Ariane Talchik, my pronouns are she and her, and I just did voice training, so I sound like shit.
My name is Jay, my pronouns are they and them, and I just bounced off the back of a minivan, so I also sound like shit.
And I'm Kira Dempsey, better known as Admiral Clydeberg. My pronouns are still she and her. I don't sound like shit.
You sound good as ever.
I hope.
No, you sound amazing. All right, next slide. Okay, so we're taking a break from our normal thing where we shitpost Fat Crash, go way into detail on things that are tangential but interesting to the three of us personally. Instead, today, we're here to raise a little money for hurricane relief.
So if any of you out there have been living under a rock, or maybe if you totally avoid all U.S. news, a couple of weeks ago, Hurricane Helene impacted six U.S. states and caused massive and widespread destruction, particularly in mountainous inland areas of Tennessee and the Carolinas, where basically all infrastructure, roads, power lines, cell towers, was just wiped off the map. So over 200 people are dead and many more missing, and the recovery is going to take years. So and when I was writing this, they're still struggling to get aid into some areas in North Carolina, particularly. By the time you're listening to this, there are definitely still areas that will be cut off. There will be places that will be cut off potentially for months.
Yeah, and just as recovery efforts for that are in full force, and as we record this, Hurricane Milton is just making landfall in Tampa, and it's looking like it's going to be brutally destructive. It's dropped to a Category 3, but it is an enormous Category 3. So the category just means that the peak wind speeds are a certain magnitude. But the thing is, it is an absolutely enormous hurricane. So it is impacting a huge area of land, and it is going to be extremely destructive.
Yeah, when we wrote this script, Milton was just a twinkle in Mother Nature's eye, but there are absolutely going to be people who will need help after Milton too, even though that wasn't what we originally wrote this episode about. We don't know exactly how many people or what their needs are going to be like we do with Helene, but there will no doubt be many, many people in Florida who will have lost everything by the time you're listening to this episode, and they will need help.
Yeah, at the time we actually wrote this, there were approximately 1.2 million people in North Carolina with no power. Right now, this minute, as we are recording this, it's down to about 140,000 because linemen are just amazing people. But that number is going to go back up in the next week, and then we're going to have to push it down again.
So next slide.
All right. So what we're going to do is up top, we're going to direct you to two organizations that we put on the screen here, and then another third we'll get to. The first is the American Red Cross. The second is the American Humane Society. You're welcome to donate to either or both. We'd like you to encourage that you do get up a little bit to one or the other if you can.
Yeah. Also, I want to direct anyone out there who is a general aviation pilot to Operation Airdrop. They're a charity that's helping to organize relief flights into smaller airports and airstrips to bring supplies to places that are currently only accessible by helicopter or by light aircraft. They're looking for pilots and planes, but if you're not either of those things but still want to help in a way that's related to aviation, you can volunteer at their staging base. There's one in Concord, North Carolina. We'll have links in the descriptions for these. I'm not sure where the Florida one is going to be because pretty much all of Florida is about to get clobbered. But there will be one, and we'll update the description in the video when we find out what that is. We're also enabling monetization on this video. I know we haven't done this in the past. All the proceeds from this monetization will go to charity. And if you don't like ads, well, I don't like hurricanes either. You're just going to have to live with it.
So today, as a way of rewarding you in advance for donating, we're just going to talk about stuff that we think that is kind of interesting and that we wanted to share with you.
Well, except me, because this is a time-sensitive issue and I was holding us up, but I will make sure to shitpost.
All right. Ready? Let's hit it. Next slide. So for the first section, I want to talk about the coolest thing in existence that you hope you never have to see, and that's a search and rescue bird.
Yeah, I can personally tell you from experience that if you ever see the inside of a medevac or a search and rescue helicopter, you are almost certainly having the worst day of your entire life. Certainly, it's going to be one of the most expensive days of your entire life. I have apparently seen the inside of one of these three times. I only remember one time, and it absolutely sucked. You do not want to get in the helicopter.
So this is a previously undiscovered variant of don't get in the helicopter, or rather maybe don't get into a situation where you have to get in the helicopter.
And especially never get yourself in a situation where you have to be placed into the helicopter.
So true.
It's like the worst ambulance ride you ever took, except it's also costing you $45,000.
Next slide. So pretty much as soon as we figured out helicopters and we realized that they didn't need runways, we realized that we could use them to land places that are very much not runways, or maybe even land to get people or to bring people or to drop supplies. Then we eventually realize that they can sit still in midair, and oh hey, if you hang a long enough rope off of the side, sometimes you can pick people up with it without having to get close to the ground or even the water. Pretty much immediately in relative terms, because sometimes dudes do rock. Helicopters as we know them are about the same age as the jet engine, even though it would be quite a while before the two were merged.
Yeah, in case you're curious, we looked this up. It was 1955, and it was Aérospatiale with the Alouette de, because the French are nothing if not bold with turbine engines. Interestingly enough, because this helicopter was also just spectacularly overpowered for its weight, a variant of it actually holds the all-up altitude record for any rotorcraft of 40,814 feet.
And here I thought the helicopter that landed on top of Mount Everest was impressive.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about almost no air up there, right?
There's enough for an airliner, but...
You could be, but it's potentially, you could be hovering over France and have an Air France flight underneath you.
So what you're saying...
You know what 40,814 feet almost is.
Is it the 410 club?
And that's flight level 410.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
So, you know, I was thinking, so was the pilot of this helicopter simply trying to join the 410 club and failed in a different way?
Next slide. We'll never miss a chance to dunk on Jesse and Peter, ever, ever, ever. All right, so the first recorded use of a helicopter to save some fools was April 22nd, 1943. So, of course, the R-4, which we have pictured in front of you, rescued a downed flight crew in what is now Myanmar, as part of the sort of China-Burma-India theater during World War II. The conditions sucked. It was hot, it was high, it was humid. These would have been hard conditions for a modern helicopter, let alone the one that you can see on your screen that's made out of fabric and paper clips. That being said, they got all four downed crew out by making the trip multiple times, because obviously this was 1943, so the paperclip could only carry one person at a time. The first recorded civilian search and rescue was set in 1945, and was also the first recorded search and rescue with the use of an in-flight hoist. Old Man Sikorsky himself worked with a New Jersey company called Breeze, who at the time made crane motors, to design an ultra-lightweight hoist that could be fitted to the actual structure of the helicopter. In this case, a nor'easter storm caused an oil barge to run aground on the Penfield Reef in Long Island Sound off the Connecticut coast. The barge, being a barge and not an amphibious assault craft, did not agree with this and started to take on water. The same conditions that ran this thing aground also kept them from being rescued by sea, and the five crew members were stranded on the barge. So what the police and Coast Guard contacted the nearby Sikorsky factory to see if they could help in any way, and they wanted to know if one of these newfangled helicopters could be used for the rescue. So they dispatched the helicopter with the modified crane hoist and its test pilot, which was Igor's actual nephew, and flew the mission, and they rescued all five of them. Again, they had to do it one at a time. Next slide. Of course, when you want to map when the tech tree of a helicopter goes into growth mode, or really any technology, you have to talk about the U.S. military. Yeah, so the military was effectively the first people to realize the value of the helicopter as a platform. It would be a while before they started attaching missiles, guns, or radars to helicopters, because those are kind of heavy, they require a lot of power, and they really only became possible with the sort of crazy thrust-weight ratio that a turbine engine can afford for you. So for a while, the main use of helicopters was for emergency medical evacuation. Now, those of you that watched Nick at Night growing up, or you just old as hell, will be hearing a theme song when you see one of these bubble-body helicopters.
Yeah, they also make that one noise that everyone thinks all helicopters make. It's actually the drive belt whistle on one of these things.
Yeah, exactly. This is a Bell 47. It's a star of MASH, one of the most beloved shows in TV history. MASH is actually a real term in Super Mobile Army Surgical Hospital. This was a tiny little death trap of a helicopter, It had a radial air-cooled engine in the back. The only way to properly evacuate casualties was to, as you can see, strap them to the skids and hope they made it back to the MASH, where Alan Alda would say something funny and probably vaguely racist.
That's insane. I can't believe they used to do that. Like, all right, Private, the good news is you don't have to get in the helicopter. The bad news is you're going to do something even worse, which is get on the helicopter, like on the outside. Let's go.
Yeah, this kind of medevac was more or less the standard for years, all through the Korean War in the 50s, until the next revolution, helicopters, Vietnam.
Are we going to actually talk about the fact that this is the second episode in a row where we've had people opting to leave in an aircraft after having been shot because there are people currently shooting at them at the location that they're currently present?
That's a good point.
Yeah, this entire next slide is really, really all about that. It was the American involvement in the Vietnamese Civil War that gave us the true genesis of the modern helicopter. The Huey, the Jolly Green, the Sea King, each of these helicopters was finally large enough to carry a hoist, a medical team, medical supplies. They could evacuate multiple men off the battlefield inside a helicopter. This was also the first generation of helicopters that were capable of slinging loads and sort of delivering things on the battlefield to forward operating bases.
Yeah, and the other sound you associate with both helicopters and indeed the Vietnam War comes from the Huey's two massive wobbly rotor blades.
I'm amused you think I have enough exposure to Vietnam-era helicopters to associate a sound with them.
I mean, a lot of people, our audience included, are not only associating a sound with these images, particularly that one at the bottom, but one of like six songs.
Having just broken all three bones in my left arm, I'm currently full of enough opioids to make unironic Paint It Black references.
Or any number of Doors references.
Yeah, I'm not planning on doing any speedballs or, you know, asphyxiating on my own vomit at any point, so don't worry about that. But I do see a red door and I want to paint it black, very definitely.
So the helicopters in the Vietnam more or less defined what search and rescue helicopters would look like for another couple of generations, until the next revolution in this field, which was around the start of the War on Terror in the early 2000s. And this time it was electronics. Next slide. So here we have what has been, for the last couple of decades, the standard bearer in search and rescue, the Sikorsky H-60. There is a number of variants of this thing. The Navy Seahawk, the Coast Guard Jayhawk, the Army's Black Hawk, and of course, the best one of all, the one you have on screen, the U.S. Air Force HH-60 Pave Hawk. This particular bird, inclusive of its next generation W model, is more or less the pinnacle of rotary search rescue at the moment. It has avionics that allow for zero visibility operations, even in mountainous terrain, which is particularly useful if it's raining or dark outside.
Say the president of Iran is yelling right now from the afterlife. Why didn't you give me this?
Why didn't you buy me this helicopter that can see the mountains? It also has in-flight refueling, which allows it to have a further effective radius than just about anything else with a Jesus nut.
And for those of you who are not aeronautically inclined, the Jesus nut is the colloquial term for this one nut that helicopters have in the rotor mechanism that supposedly will cause catastrophic loss of the helicopter if it fails. And I don't know enough about helicopters to tell you exactly how that works, because I try to stay as far away from them as possible.
It's also important to point out that while this is, you know, very clearly a helicopter, it's also a member of the U.S. Air Force's PAVE family of technologies, which we are going to come back to in a moment.
Indeed, yeah. All right, next slide. So a substantial number of these helicopters are operated by the National Guards of each state. So for our non-American or just not aware audience, the National Guard is a part-time reserve force that the U.S. military operates. These are folks that have day jobs. They're teachers, lawyers, paramedics. Some of them are helicopter pilots for their day jobs, too. But the difference between the Air and Army National Guards of each state versus the U.S. military is that unless these are deployed, sort of what they're called federalized, these forces report to the governor of their state, not to the commander-in-chief. So this means they can be deployed for civilian purposes. It also means they can be deployed all but instantaneously, and they can begin to spin up the largest and most complex thing on the planet, which is the Department of Defense logistics.
The National Guard and the fact that they report to the state governor also gives speculative fiction writers a way to suspend the reader's disbelief when they introduce the events of American Civil War Part 2, unless the reader knows anything about the National Guard, in which case that won't work.
Yeah, so these National Guard search and rescue units became famous sort of very much against their will during Katrina. A lot of them have described it as the most traumatic experience of their entire lives. I've done disaster response in the Guard a little bit. It's backbreaking and it's miserable work. Your body is beaten and broken. You don't really get to eat much. You're lucky if you get 4 hours of sleep a day that you're working. All in, though, it's work no guardsman would ever fail to volunteer for, because these are their fellow citizens. Civil disaster relief is incredibly rewarding, despite it being something you hope you're never called up for.
So I also want to shout out the search and rescue guys at what I assume was the National Park Service, who are literally the reason I am alive and on this podcast, even though helicopters aren't involved, as far as I remember. Because when I was 4 years old, I wandered off into the desert in Joshua Tree National Park and was missing for, I forget exactly how long, probably 8 to 12 hours. So I was climbing on some rocks, and my mom shouted for me to come down because we were going to go for a walk. And I climbed down the opposite side of the boulder pile, where suddenly I couldn't see my parents, I couldn't see the parking lot, I couldn't see anything man-made at all. And because I was a four-year-old who hadn't developed object permanence, this caused my little brain to malfunction, and I just wandered off into the desert. So after a while, my mom realized I hadn't come running, at which point a desperate search ensued that eventually escalated to search and rescue when they couldn't find me. I, meanwhile, didn't realize the seriousness of the situation at all, because my parents had told me what to do if I ever got lost in the desert, so I assumed this was a very common occurrence and probably no big deal. Eventually, I got hungry. I decided I could eat those big black desert ants, because I remembered my dad telling me one time that, quote, some people eat bugs, end quote. Well, it turns out usually not those bugs, and usually they cook them, but I didn't know that. So I'm pretty sure the search for me did involve helicopters, but it was actually the ground teams that found me with their search and rescue dogs. And evening was falling by the time they picked me up, and who knows if I'd have survived a night. This was in March and high elevation, so it wasn't that warm. But in the end, it worked out, and a picture of my dad holding me ended up on the front page of some tiny local newspaper. I think my mom still has that somewhere. So anyway, thank your local search and rescue teams, folks, especially the ones that have been out there in North Carolina rescuing people for the past 2 weeks. But I also want to shout out to my mom for not becoming a helicopter parent after that. Haha, get it. I don't know where she found the self-control. Just saying.
All right. Hell yeah. So we've talked about helicopters that can help get you out of a hurricane. Now we're going to talk about the tech that lets you see it coming in the first place. In other words, let's talk about what happens when you hook up a Wi-Fi router to enough kilowatts of power that you can see air. Jay, all yours. Next slide.
Oh, yeah. So let's talk about weather radar.
For those of you who are not in the CPIT Discord, Jay rants about weather radar a lot. It's like one of the local landmarks. If you go over there, you'll see Jay ranting about weather radar. Anyway.
We're going to start with LLWAS, which is not radar.
LWAS.
So this is an LLWAS mast, which may be pronounced LWAS. I have no idea.
I'm pretty sure it's pronounced LWAS.
Yeah, well, the LL does not stand for ladies' love, and I'm...
Dang.
I'm told I'm much cooler than that other cool J you may have heard of. Before Terminal Doppler Weather Radar, there was the Low-Level Wind Shear Alert System, which was developed in 1976. It was trying to do much the same thing, but on a smaller scale and using less interesting technology. Actually, a bunch of maybe 30 anemometers on poles. It was kind of jank.
Okay, so the first question is, what the heck is this thing? And what kind of maniac would put 30 of them near an airport?
I don't know. I'd do it. Seems fine to me. And, I mean, what they did is... If the wind was blowing in a different speed or direction at one anemometer, and then another anemometer a mile away was showing something totally different, boom, you knew that there was wind shear, which is really important if you're about to fly into that.
Yes, but there were slight problems.
Yes, it's sometimes kind of worked.
Notably, besides being a huge hazard to Aero Sucre flight crews.
Oh my god.
They paid for the whole runway? They're using the whole runway.
Ladies Love Was didn't work very well. Planes did keep crashing at random, which is why we developed things like aircraft-mounted wind shear radar and LIDAR. And what we use instead now for the same purpose, which we'll talk about in a moment.
Yeah, and by at random, you mean, quote, when they flew into microbursts whose diameter was less than the distance between any two LWAS sensors.
Potato, potato.
For more, read the Admiral's article on Pan Am Flight 759.
Boy, that's an old one, but yeah.
Next slide. All right, let's talk about super fancy weather radar.
It's Terminal Doppler Weather Radar Time, or TWR, which also stands for Things Don't Work Right. I came up with that on the spot. The radar itself works fine, for the record.
Terminal Doppler would be a solid drag name for the right crowd.
Yep, Terminal Doppler Weather Radar, TDWR. What's a TDWR? Well, it's a partly electronically scanned, synthetic aperture assisted, 3D pencil beam, frequency agile, pain in my ass is what it is. TDWR is supposed to be to weather radar what the big BMUs radars are to spotting incoming ICBMs, what the paved pause radars are to spotting incoming short-range missiles.
What?
So what Jay means is that TWR is like an over-the-horizon missile watch system, and then it uses huge amounts of power and huge amounts of computing processing to cover a ton of sky.
Yeah, so you can spot incoming tornadoes and not the fighter jet.
Indeed. So, you know, while the Dewline may have been able to spot incoming bombers, it wouldn't have been very good for spotting incoming ICBMs. And similarly, your NEXRAD radar didn't have the resolution required to spot microbursts or even smaller tornadoes, right? It's not a very high resolution radar, and it doesn't update very frequently.
And LWAS was worse.
Yes, LWAS was bad in every sense of the word. LWAS did not, well, ladies did not love it. Let's just say that. Anyway, after Delta 191, the NTSB said, hey guys, these things keep happening. Please do something about it. And the FAA, I don't know, they must have been like recently on vacation or drunk or something. In a break from tradition, they decided to actually do something about it rather than just say, no, we're not going to do anything about it. They finally decided that NEXRAD, which was the status quo weather radar system, wasn't high enough resolution, either spatially or temporally, to deal with these things like microbursts or the like clusters of little dust devils that you get of lumpy air around a microburst. And then they realized that they had no idea what they were doing, and they asked NASA to help. So they asked a team at NASA Ames to help them, and then NASA Ames asked the MIT Lincoln Labs folks to help, because I guess they had their phone number on a post-it or something. And then MIT took one look at the problem that NASA had given them and said, well, this looks like a job for just stupendous amounts of computational power and megawatt microwave pulses.
That is MIT's one move.
It's a very effective one move as moves go. But yeah, it is pretty much their one move. Okay, and as you can see here, on the left is a TDWR image. On the right is a NEXRAD image. And it should be immediately apparent how much finer the spatial resolution of TDWR is. It's not just finer in terms of spatial resolution. It's also finer in terms of temporal resolution. And it's not just that, but it also has finer resolution in terms of the velocities of the elements of the storm that it is imaging.
As what you're seeing on screen here is TDWR and NEXRAD images of a supercell that's possibly producing a tornado, it looks like. And you can tell which one you'd rather be using. And then a microburst is even harder for NEXRAD to detect, but can be detected with TDWR. And a microburst is basically what you get when cold air from the top of a thunderstorm falls down to the bottom of the thunderstorm. Let's put it that way. This column of cold air is typically much less than a mile in diameter, so it will slot right in between the mile apart sensors of an LWAS system. And it will also be too small for the resolution of a NEXRAD radar. This column of air then hits the ground and spreads out in all directions with extreme straight-line winds surrounding a powerful central downdraft, which is basically kryptonite for airplanes. And I should also add, for people who are already familiar with the story of Delta Flight 191 and its aftermath, this is separate from the airborne Doppler weather radar systems that allow aircraft to generate in-flight wind shear alerts. They're built on the same technological principles, but they have different uses and abilities.
And just here for the listeners, could you explain, like, why is wind shear deadly to an aircraft and why is it deadly so suddenly?
So wind shear is deadly to aircraft because when the wind changes direction and or magnitude very suddenly, an aircraft's airspeed is also going to change very suddenly because the speed of the aircraft relative to the air is absolutely everything. It's life. So if you go from a 20-knot headwind to a 20-knot tailwind, all of a sudden the speed of the airplane relative to the Earth doesn't change, but its speed relative to the surrounding air is going to decrease by 40 knots, and that could cause the airplane to instantly stall. So the issue with a microburst specifically is as the plane flies toward the microburst, it will encounter the outflow winds, and this will cause the airspeed to increase. So the pilot tends to pull thrust back to try to reduce airspeed, if they don't realize they're going to a microburst. So then after they penetrate the front edge of the outflow from the microburst, they then enter the central downdraft, which slams the aircraft downward toward the ground, and it's already at low thrust. So the pilot is going to try to power out of this by pushing thrust back up, but just as they do so, they're going to start to exit out the other side of the microburst, and now they have a strong tailwind from the outflow on the other side, and that means that the plane may not have enough performance to actually recover from the downdraft, because suddenly all that thrust you added isn't doing anything. Your airspeed's not increasing, and you're still going down because the downdraft just pushed you down. And that's what caused the crash of Delta Flight 191 and quite a few other crashes as well.
Yeah, and that's also why this is most dangerous in the immediate environment of the airport, which is why LLWAS was the low-level wind shear alert system. And it's also what the T in TDWR means. It's the terminal Doppler weather radar. It's designed for the very beginning and the very end of each flight so that you can get this very high resolution imaging in the immediate environment around the airport and the sort of 5, 10, 15 miles around it, because that's when the planes are closest to the ground and therefore most sensitive to these kinds of disturbances. So TDWR can detect patterns of interest by scanning its entire field of view once a minute, which would be impossible to do if it wasn't assisted by a suite of technologies that it inherited from the US Air Force PAVE family of technologies and PAVE PAWS, and indeed the PAVE Hawk helicopter that we were just talking about, were all part of this electronic advancement in imaging and radar systems. And TDWR includes technology that's derived from this. It's one of the things that MIT's Lincoln Labs actually contributed to. And then if it sees something in this entire field of view, there's intelligence in the system that can use pattern matching to then concentrate on a specific area to scan at a higher resolution if there's something important happening there. And it does this using a sort of suite of technologies, including something called frequency agility, where if it finds it can get better imaging in a slightly different part of the radio spectrum, it can actually move there instantaneously so that it can get the best possible signal to noise ratio. Usually it lives right in the middle of 5 gigahertz, around 5500, 5600 megahertz. Ironically, Wi-Fi people refer to this as the weather radar no-fly zone, which is funny because it's specifically for the safety of planes.
And you might be shocked I guess Jay might be shocked by the number of people who have no idea that frequency band allocation is even a thing. So listener, if you're one of these people, what Jay is saying is that there's a whole band of frequencies that can't be used for your Wi-Fi or your radio or whatever because they're reserved exclusively for terminal Doppler weather radar. And this is something the average person never thinks about, but that Jay has to think about every day because they're a nerd, sorry, an engineer.
Look, not many podcasts get to have an adventure as a host.
That's true.
Look, let's move on to the next slide, which is all about what this exactly is. This wonderful image is the 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi and ISM band where your 11AC, 11AX radios mostly operate, right? Between channels 36 and 165. You can see there right in the middle, between channels 120 and 128, that is the weather radar no-fly zone. You are not allowed to operate there at all. 116 and 132, you might be, depending on some circumstances. Currently not in the USA, but in some other countries it might be.
What happens if you violate this?
Oh, we'll go into that in a moment.
Okay.
So then there's this purple region, which we call DFS channels. So DFS stands for dynamic frequency selection. And what this is saying is that your Wi-Fi device is allowed to use this. But firstly, it has to have been tested as being capable of detecting all of the various waveforms that TDWR uses. Right? So the FCC gets this documentation package from the FAA every time they update how TDWR works. And the FCC then makes this available to Wi-Fi manufacturers and also to, well, actually, it's currently only one testing lab and they're in Washington, D.C., and it's a complete pain. But they make it available to other testing labs so that you can do what's called a pre-scan and pre-test it. And what you have to do is you have to take your Wi-Fi stuff and you have to build in detection code that can detect that a TDWR just showed up in your channel and then prove that you can immediately leave that channel in less than a minute. Right? And all of your clients have to come with you. You cannot use that channel then for another, it depends what channel it is specifically and what country you're in, but you're not allowed to use that channel again for a defined length of time. It used to be an hour. It can be a half hour in some places. It can be 10 minutes in other places, but they take this extremely seriously. The FCC has zero chill about this. And they do this because when the FAA tells them to do something and stops people stomping on the Uni 2 band when TDWR is using it, is something that the FAA told them to do in no uncertain terms, your company may be at risk if you fail to comply with the FCC's rules. They have in the past levied such vast fines that major companies have gone under just because of them. My opinion of this, I'm not speaking for my employer, obviously, is good. Don't screw with radar. This stuff is important.
Isn't an FCC fine so massive that the company literally could not go on living, was how Linksys died?
Allegedly, that might be how Cisco bought them for cheap. Might be.
Oh, Cisco. I remember I briefly had a job when I was in college where I was delivering cookies by bicycle in downtown San Francisco. So I went to all the offices of all these big tech companies that have downtown SF offices. One of them was Cisco. And I remember that they had a bowl on their desk that was giving out candy to delivery people. So shout out to that.
That's an adorable story.
It is an adorable story.
I'm just wondering if you've ever come to my office now at this point. So on the upside, since TDWR was implemented, there haven't been any major microburst-induced crashes within certain parameters, which is good.
Yeah, and I should clarify what within certain parameters means, because there haven't been any major crashes due to microbursts at airfields where TDWR is actually installed. So in 1994, US Air lost a DC-9 in Charlotte due to a microburst, and it turned out that the FAA hadn't installed TDWR at Charlotte yet because they were stuck in a price dispute with the guy who owned the plot of land where they intended to put it. There was also a crash in Pakistan in 2012 due to a microburst with a healthy dose of incompetence. This is a completely recoverable microburst if the pilots had done anything at all. But also, Pakistan doesn't have terminal Doppler weather radar at all, as far as I can tell, or at least they didn't at the time. So there's your asterisks.
One thing I have learned studying airplane crashes is that a lot of times planes crash for really stupid fucking reasons.
It's true, but not having it,
especially in Pakistan.
Well, this is also true. But not having a TDWR is not a stupid reason, because next slide. So look at this frickin' thing. It is huge. They are incredibly expensive. The TDWR data is apparently, according to the FAA document on this, two planes on a thing called a ribbon display terminal. I guess this is integrated into the flight deck displays on more recent planes, but I couldn't find any information about this.
We can harass Fox about it later.
Yeah, I have never heard of this. I'm familiar with airborne wind shear detection systems, but not whatever this ribbon thing is. I'm sorry, I have no idea.
I'm pretty sure that the TDWR alert warnings actually do go to the airborne wind shear detection thing. So you do get an annunciator alarm and, you know, all of that stuff when they happen. But I think there is a more detailed message. I just don't know where it ends up. The makers of these radars, though, keep developing new software for TDWR to improve its performance. So it does get better over time, which is both neat and, again, as you might imagine, kind of annoying, because obviously, if they're updating what these radars are doing, then we have to be updating what the Wi-Fi radios that are supposed to detect them are doing. And so there's a whole treadmill involved in that where the entire industry is sort of following them along.
I'm so glad I don't have to think about that.
Yeah, you don't. You just have to keep buying the good Wi-Fi stuff. On the other hand, these are astonishingly expensive machines to build and operate. Even just the electricity to run one is millions of dollars a year. And there are dozens of the bloody things.
This is one of the reasons why Hartsfield, which is kind of obviously in the middle of a huge tornado area, has its own dedicated power substation, as well as a backup dedicated power substation.
Yeah, I mean, we have this image of the radar, and as you can tell, this thing is very large. The golf ball that you see on the slide is actually quite a ways behind the full-sized house-sized building that contains the signal processing equipment for it. They are detectable for hundreds of miles, which is amazing if you think about the fact that these operate on the same frequencies as 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi.
My Google Nest Wi-Fi is barely detectable in the next room.
Yeah, so what you're telling me is we could solve RA's problem by repurposing a single terminal Doppler weather radar to provide 5G Wi-Fi throughout the entire state of Georgia. And this is a fantastic idea. I will take no questions.
And, you know, speaking personally, the frequency agile part is the most annoying because it means it can just suddenly decide, oh, yeah, I'm in Uni 2A now, and Kool-Aid man its way into your channel. And you just have to leave. You just have to leave. It's like the worst house guest. I'm not bitter at all.
Yeah, anyway, you can join the CPIT Discord to hear Jay repeat this exact same rant every time weather radar is even tangentially mentioned. And this is where I was supposed to write something about an undisclosed topic. Actually, I'm not going to undisclose the topic. I'm going to disclose the topic. I was going to write about hurricane hunters, but I didn't do it, Professor. I'm so sorry. Yeah, next slide, please.
All right, I'm going to hit you with the slide again. Just remind you to donate. We've got options if you like people, animals, airplanes, or any combination of the three. We'll have links in the description for all three.
Yeah, and you know, if you do want to watch this video again with your ad blocker turned off, all of the ad revenue is going directly to one of these three charities.
If you pay for YouTube Premium as well, all of that revenue will go to the charities. All right. Thanks everyone for joining us. Our next episode will be on, when we get back to regular, we'll be back on to Malaysia Aero 370. Good night.
Good night.
Thanks very much and stay safe.